Hey guys, just a quick heads up. We've just launched our brand new investment opportunity called Alessia Gardens in the Greater Atlanta MSA. Now, through RSN Property Group, I've been investing in multifamily for over a decade, acquiring nearly $1 billion in assets and delivering investors an average 27% annual return. Now, if you want to invest alongside of me in this latest deal, head over to www.rsnpropertygroup.com/call to schedule a quick chat with one of our team members. That's www.rsnpropertygroup.com/call.
Around the time we got involved in multifamily, there was a lot of people getting into this business, right? And because people were making money and that draws attention. And people, they sign up for a mentorship program, they learn how to underwrite a deal, they find some friends to give them some money, but they forget about the third part of the business, which is running the freaking deal after you close.
Welcome to Investing in the US, a podcast for real estate investors, business owners, and aspiring entrepreneurs looking to grow their wealth by investing in US real estate. I'm your host, Reid Goossens, and so far, I've acquired over $800 million worth of investments on various properties across the United States. On this podcast, I interview go-getters, risk takers, and the best in the business to learn more about their investment journey and the cutting-edge strategies they are applying towards building a legacy. For more on growing your own wealth and by investing in the US, visit www.reidgoossens.com.
Today on the show, I have the pleasure of chatting with Jonathan Nichols. Now, Jonathan is a real estate investor based in DFW, and with nearly a decade of experience as an aerospace propulsion engineer, he transitioned into real estate investing back in 2018 with his wife, Paula. Together, they founded Apogee Capital in 2019, and Jonathan's experience includes 8 multifamily and 1 self-storage project totaling over 1,000 units as a GP and additionally 1,000 units as a limited partner. He also manages a 20-unit portfolio of short-term rentals in Arlington's Entertainment District. Jonathan enjoys helping others, racing in Ironman triathlons with his wife, Paula. But enough out of me. Let's get him out here. G'day, Jonathan. Welcome to the show. How are you doing today, mate?
Hey, Reid. Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Mate, we were just chatting a lot offline. You and I have hung out together a few times in some masterminds. I got to know you a little bit. I got to know your wife. But big news, mate. You baby on the way, right?
I know, right? And it's interesting because it's like a little bit stressful. I'm sure you can relate to that. But I always remind my son, Paula, like we got into real estate to have more opportunities when we had kids, you know, and not that everything's perfect or we have it all figured out now, but seeing the opportunities we have, like both working from home and stuff like that today is, I feel like it's just an exciting time. Yeah, we're excited.
In that introduction there, I didn't actually realize you've got, you know, I've known you for your multifamily acquisitions, but it seems like you've got a few different other irons in the fire. I didn't realize you had a short-term rental business. Was that pre-multi or post-multi? How's that come about?
Yeah, so it's a funny story. It's pre-multifamily. You know, I think you read my background. I worked as an aerospace engineer for a local company here in Dallas about 8 or 9 years. And I was on vacation one year with my wife, Paula, and read this book called The 4-Hour Workweek and got this idea, like, how do I build a business where I work 4 hours a week and it pays me what my engineering job does, right? And so at that time, we had just bought our first single family property, which was a 4-unit fourplex, and it's 2 blocks from the Cowboys Stadium here in Arlington, Texas. And so we got the idea, hey, let's convert it to short-term rental for cash flow. And pretty much as the rest is history, we kept buying more and more properties. And I think a lot of people think that I first left my job from multifamily. That's kind of the assumption. But it was actually the short-term rental income that allowed me to pivot and jump out of it and pursue multifamily full-time. So I don't do as much acquisitions or growing on that business now, but we do still own and operate all those properties. And it's a good business for the most part.
The headlines have been, you know, short-term rentals are getting whacked right now across the country. It was such a hot topic for such a long period of time. How are yours faring in the modern world today?
Yeah, so the stuff we bought early on, like let's say pre-COVID or during COVID, we got it at such a great basis that even with the reduced rates and reduced occupancy that we're seeing in the short-term rental market, it's freaking killing it because it's just not over-leveraged, you know. These are all single family properties. We have 1 commercial 8-unit. So most of them we fixed, you know, 3.5% on these properties like 4 or 5 years ago. So they're fine, right? Like if your rates drop 10-20%, it's not a big deal when you have that. The newer stuff that we've bought has been It's been okay. To the point where like, we're not super, you know, gung ho to go buy more, but it's not underwater either. And so, you know, kind of my perspective of that is we've had our run with that business. We're going to keep doing it. At some point in the future, we'll probably sell them all and put it into some other asset class that's a little more scalable. But it really just depends to when you bought the property, how much it's leveraged and how good you are operating it as to how well you're doing today.
Yeah, no, I don't know anything about the short-term rental market. I've had a few people on the show talking about it. It seemed like a no-brainer, right? A couple of years back when the industry was booming, people had money in their pockets, but a lot of crackdowns with local cities on the particularly studios in one bedrooms, because it was really driving up rents in that, you know, on those two specific unit types themselves. And so has Dallas had the same sort of wave of legislation come through on the short-term rental space?
It has, and it's interesting. So we live in Arlington, which people that don't know Dallas-Fort Worth geography, it's right in the middle between Dallas-Fort Worth. I've lived here ever since I moved here. That's where all our short-term rentals are. And so we're under all the Arlingtons. And they were actually one of the first municipalities in DFW to establish rules. And so there's only a certain area you can do it in. You have to pay a hot tax, get permitting, yada, yada, yada. And it's one of those things where if you know the game and you can play by the rules, you'll be okay, right? I think in some scenarios, we're actually kind of blessed because even though Arlington was one of the first ones to establish it, we knew what the playbook was. Whereas a lot of other cities, it was just sort of out there in the cloud and you don't know, are they going to ban it completely? Is it going to be in an area where I'm not? Is the rates and stuff going to be too high in terms of taxes? So we've pretty much been on since they established STR rules and just rode the playbook with them, so to speak.
Gotcha. That's awesome. Well, let's pivot and now talk about the multifamily landscape. As I mentioned, you and I have hung out a few times at some mastermind events. I had the pleasure of hanging out with you and your wife. Was it, I can't remember, year ago, year and a half ago in Dallas, just east of
Dallas, and then I think Atlanta.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And had a good chance to get to know you guys. And so what's the acquisitions been looking like for you in you know, 2024, 2025, coming out of, you know, the peak, we've seen rates drop, or sorry, pricing drop. We've seen rental rates drop. How's the one, the existing portfolio going, and two, how are you seeing new opportunities on the horizon?
Yeah, I'll talk about the acquisitions front first. So I think towards the maybe middle to end of 2023, my investing philosophy from what I was seeing underwriting deals was a lot of like stabilized light value add deals with new debt were just not making sense. You know, your cap rates were not high enough. You're not getting any cash flow. And it just did not make sense to me from an investment perspective. And so we really had two strategies. One was to pivot and do heavy value add deals. So something that's, you know, low occupancy, mom and pop managed, that kind of thing. Or do loan assumptions. And the critical thing with the loan assumption is that you don't overpay for the asset just because you're getting the good loan, right? It's one thing to pay a little bit of a premium, but you don't want to way overpay back to like 2022 prices just because you have a 3.5% interest rate. So since then, we've done two loan assumption deals, one in Tulsa, Oklahoma, one in Norman, Oklahoma, which we closed the Norman one last year. And we've done one heavy value add that we closed summer of last year in Lubbock, Texas. And so what that looked like is like mom and pop owners for 35 years, 65% occupied, generally took good care of the property, but did not have like modern management and marketing procedures. And so we were able to get it at a very deep discount, both due to the multifamily economy in general, and because bridge debt is so expensive, you get a further discount on deals if you have to go the bridge debt route. But that's kind of been our strategies. And on the acquisitions front, I'm hoping that some of the stabilized stuff is kind of opening up now. Particularly, you have buyers who they've been able to kick, or owners that have been able to kick the can down the road on debt that's expiring the last year or so. And now they're, unfortunately for them, you know, maybe fortunately for us, running out of time. So there may be some opportunities to get some of those, I would say, less hairy deals at a discount nonetheless.
Look, talk about the hairiness, because you're at ground zero, right, for the multifamily explosion that we've had in the last 10 years. You know, let's, you know, the gurus are all there, and but you're probably also ground zero for some you know, some more, I know I'm seeing, which is blood in the street. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and what you're seeing out there, you know, with these extend and pretends and just, you know, some of the struggles current operators are having, or what you're seeing?
This could be a whole hour conversation in and of itself, right? There's a lot to say. You know, we started in the multifamily syndication business during COVID. So, you know, we were buying at, you know, within a year, year and a half of the height of the market, basically, is when we started. We're pretty fortunate that the few deals that we did before, you know, that market peak were all pretty solid deals. Like, we didn't get any on bridge debt, all fixed rate debt. So we actually have one that we're anticipating an exit hitting projections later this year that we closed in 21, you know. Which is kind of hard to come across right now. And I don't think it, I'd love to just say like, oh, we're, you know, geniuses or whatever. I think it was all just kind of a bit of dumb luck and not wanting to go chase some crazy high leverage debt product in the market. But yeah, so we've been pretty fortunate on the active side of the portfolio. On the limited partner side, not so much. We've had two deals that we invested in strictly as limited partners that have been foreclosed on in the last, you know, 6 months. And so that's a bit of a sting, right? But I think the thing that both of those deals had in common was particularly poor asset managing, like not executing the business plan, not getting in day one and doing what, you know, you said you were going to do to for your investors on the property in terms of renovations, in terms of management, occupancy, all that stuff. And that's not to say that every deal that goes bad right now is due to poor asset management. I don't believe that's the case. But it's just, if you don't have good asset management, you really don't have much of a prayer today. So yeah, that's definitely a theme I'm seeing is sponsors that have not been strong on asset management are exiting the game either forcefully or, you know, maybe just tired of it and getting out. But the ones that you know, have pretty tight operations are generally floating through. I don't know if that gets the heart of your question, but
yeah, no. It does. So, you know, I'm sorry to hear that you've been involved in some deals, and you know, I'm hearing deals that I've been involved in has also been, you know, going to foreclosure as a limited partner, and it's kind of what's happening right now. And if the people are listening to this, if you don't know that it's happening, you know, blood is in the street, and a lot more blood than there was a year ago, 2 years ago, and with the extend and pretend. So a lot more keys are being handed back. And that's an indication that banks have had enough, right? They were trying to extend and they said, you know what? Enough's enough. You know. So talk a little bit about that asset management. You don't have to name names, like, please, we're respectful. But when you mention, oh, if they were just doing the asset management better, do you think that would have got you guys not in a foreclosure situation, or was it always going to head that way because of the debt? And it just, and because there's other forces out there, right? We've had, you know, interest rates rise, but also we've had rental rates significantly drop. So out of those two things, would asset management have saved those deals, you know, wholeheartedly?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, I'd like to say I can answer it 100% accurately. I don't know if I can, but a few things I would say, you know, acknowledging there are headwinds, you know, all them that you mentioned here in Texas, combined with crazy rising insurance tax costs, it's been extremely tough. I would say this, I think that there was around the time we got involved in multifamily, so, you know, let's call it 5 years or so after yourself, there was a lot of people getting into this business, right? And because people were making money and that draws attention. And so, you know, people, they sign up for a mentorship program, they learn how to underwrite a deal, they find some friends to give them some money, but they forget about the third part of the business, which is running the freaking deal after you close. And you really need someone on your team that has project management skills, like project management acumen. And I'll be honest, like, I am okay. I am not, that's not like my wheelhouse. You know, I understand it. But my wife, Paula, is amazing at it. You know, like, she knows how to drive meetings and processes and, you know, tasks, workflows, et cetera. And she's really incredible at it. So I really have to give her all the credit for that on the active side. But yeah, a lot of people didn't realize that took work. And so I don't know that good asset management was a guarantee not to have, you know, foreclosures or major issues on your deals. But it definitely was a for sure that you're going to not make it through if you didn't. On these two particular deals, and, you know, I won't mention names or anything like that, but just to give a flavor, like, you know, you close a deal, let's call it early 2021, and it's not a huge multifamily. So it's not like a 300 unit where it's going to take you 4 years to renovate. You know, it's a business plan you should be able to whip through in 12 to 18 months, getting units renovated, rents up, occupancy up. And you get floating rate bridge because that makes the most sense on the deal. Well, if you execute the business plan and you get to, let's call it beginning of Q2 of 2022, and you're 95% occupied with your pro forma rents and rent rates start going up, you just refile. Like that's all you do is lock in a 4% rate instead of a 3% and call it a day. But when you're 75 or 80% occupied, and you're still at low rent rates because you haven't performed, that's when you're hosed. And so, you know, it kind of depends when you bought and all that. But I think there's a lot of them that were achievable business plans, but just not having your foot on the gas from day one with executing on it.
Yeah. No, look, I tend to agree. There's always hindsight 2020, right? Like you could have oh, I'd love to have locked in that rate in March of 2022, you know, and I don't think everyone thought it'd be as aggressive as what it was. So, you know, but I hear you what you're saying, like getting in and doing the work and being in a position to have that option, right? When writing's on the wall. I know from my perspective, that, you know, and I'd love your thoughts on this. I kind of see there's probably half a dozen things at play here that I want the listeners, and then I'd love your thoughts on. One was stimulus money is not spoken about enough. I'm not trying to get political, but when post COVID, right or wrong, there was stimulus money in people's pockets, right? People also didn't want to live next to each other with each other. Thus, we saw across the Sun Belt with population moving and people moving, these rent rolls stating rents that is a snapshot in time. That when the spigot turns off, they normalize. And that, I think, is some of the things we don't talk enough about. That, yes, interest rates went to the moon. That's a thing. Yes, there was COVID. But when you're making a financial decision and say, oh, I think you get $1,900 rent on these two bedrooms when historically they're probably only $1,400 or $1,500, and now we've seen them drop back down, that's, I think, where people got a lot of too far out over their skis, in my opinion. I don't know if you would agree with that sort of, again, we only get when you access a deal, you get a snapshot of a rent roll at that period of time. That's it. You don't get, you do get to see them in T12 trailing numbers, but at the time you would have thought, oh, this is going to keep going to the moon, and it didn't. And that's, I think that's where a lot of people also got, they couldn't execute their business plan because it doesn't make sense to go spend $12,000 a unit if you get negative rent growth. So it's a little bit of a two sides of the same coin.
No, I think you hit on something important there. You know, people were not just, you know, oversight on debt, which, as you mentioned, none of us necessarily saw rates increasing at the velocity they did. But there was a lot of other oversight on assumptions. Obviously, cap rates, which are tied to interest rates for sure. I mean, correlated at least, right? And then the rent growth, right? And so I forget, because it's been a few years since I've been an engineer, but I think it's like deviation to the norm, right? Over time, if you chart out like rents going up and or even maybe price per unit or any other metric, which really ties to the fundamentals of real estate, right? We invest in real estate because it goes up in value over time. Like that's the whole point, right? But yeah, if you take a little snapshot right when it goes up and don't realize there's a bigger picture going on, and you've got to come back down before you continue, that probably gives you a lot more insight into what was really going on in the economy at the time. And so, yeah, you had a lot of sponsors here in Dallas, just to give an example, you know, we had double digit rent growth here. And they're like, hey, we're going to be conservative and underwrite our deal to 6% rent growth the next 4 years. And compared to the 12% they'd seen the previous two, that was conservative. Compared to the normal, let's call it 3.5% or 4% or whatever Dallas has been for the last 30, 40 years, it was not. And not only did they not get that 3.5% or 4%, they've actually been flat the last 2 years. And so, you know, that just kind of puts a nail in the coffin when it comes to assumptions being against you.
Yeah. And then you add in insurance going to the moon. Like I remember when I first did my first deal in San Antonio, $250 a door for insurance was the cost, right? And then, you know, in Dallas today, I know because I just closed on a deal. You know, the norm's $1,200. That's in a 10-year period, right? That's gone up whatever that math is, 100, you know, more than that's, you know, times by three, you know, whatever, what 3,000% or whatever the number, I can't do the math, but you understand that there's other issues that add to the assumptions that no one would have underwritten to in the time that also these other things. And that goes back to, there's probably a half a dozen issues that, and I personally believe we have seen not only we've been in a recession for longer, given the data from the delinquency that I think that our blue collar renters show us, but two, we are in a 2008-esque type of recession in commercial multi, but it's not in the headlines because it's not the American dream, right? And yeah. I think, you know, like it's big boys and girls making big boys and girl decisions. Yeah, you know, excuse my language, stiff shit. But there is blood and you're seeing it and I'm seeing it and it's a great time to be buying. So let's pivot and talk a little bit about how you're buying or if you're buying right now. Because I know we're active in the market, but it's been a slog with investors. What are investors telling you and your wife when, you know, they come and knock and saying, hey, when's Apogee getting the next deal going? Or, you know, has there been a bit of a pullback?
Yeah, it's interesting. And honestly, you probably could give more insight on this in the last 6 to 8 months because we closed out our deals last year and we're just now kind of getting back to looking at more deals. I would say on the investor front, you know, it's people are very, very stagnant, very tough to get them to move. Like I mentioned, all the investors that I have that personally have just invested with me, they don't necessarily have the foreclosure stigma. So it's not like, oh, they've invested with a bunch of other operators and lost their money and that's why they're not investing. Although in some cases, that's why people are not in the syndication world as a whole. I think it's more just a sense of like where we are in the economy. So like, you know, you mentioned expenses going up, right? And, you know, I have a lot of middle-class investors and even, you know, they're accredited or whatever, like they've had all their stuff go up, you know, their insurance, their taxes, their kids' expenses, et cetera. And there's just a general sentiment about investing that's negative right now. And regardless of what everyone says about commercial real estate, and it's very logically based, so much emotion behind it, especially on the investor front. And so if they're watching the news every day and they're hearing recession this and interest rate not coming down that, you know, they're going to be, it's easier for them just to say no and pass and tell a future deal than it is to, you know, really think through it and jump in.
The other thing that's sort of so interesting about this space, and I've been in it, you know, since 2013, 14, is the tech right around multi. Why was multi so attractive back in the day? It was because of ambiguity, right? You didn't know, you couldn't at a click of a button figure out what the rents are within a mile. Today, it's so, the bar's so low. Like, there was, as you mentioned earlier, just a flood of people. It's a very busy lane because, you know, the ambiguity has been taken out of. I can, you know, very quickly determine what my average rents for a studio within a mile at a click of a button. 10 years ago, that was a lot harder, right? Mm. And I think that element is also missed a little bit. There's also the obviously the Jobs Act that changed in 2012, where, you know, investors can invest directly with sponsors. I think the alternative asset, it's less alternative, you know, so you're getting the bigger insurance agencies and hedge funds coming into the space. And so that drives down cap rates, right? And you know, cash flow is nearly non-existent on some of these deals. So that doesn't mean there's not deals out there, because I think we've seen a bit of a pricing correction, but it's trying to educate investors with such a euphoric run of the past 10 years. In my opinion, there was always going to be a pullback. And we're here. We're in it right now. So, you know, we're out in the street actively trying to raise for deals now, and we're picking up these deals 30, 40% below this quote-unquote peak. And that peak, we might look back at that peak in 10 years' time and say that was just a blip in the radar, you know, to your standard deviation thing. But it's still a data point, right? And you've got to measure against it. So I think in general, the fundamentals are still there. And I hope you agree that multi's still needed. We didn't even talk about supply, but you know, there's so many facets here of what has caused us to be in this stimulus money, COVID, tech, you know, in low interest rates, high interest rate, like your supply, like there's, as I said, there's about half a dozen things that's led this to this perfect storm over the last 5 years of why we're here where we are today. Would you agree?
A few things. One is that, you know, mentioned supply, right? You know, there was so much new supply coming in the market, especially large markets like Dallas, and that's dropping off. We're past those peak delivery points now. And what that means effectively is we're going to see rent growth come back in the next probably 12 months, let's say, you know, and at that point, we'll probably be on a more normal schedule of a few percent per year, like what we've seen historically. I think another thing you mentioned, fundamentals. I think that a lot of investors who both active and passive who came in this industry, call it, you know, around 2020, plus or minus a couple of years, are used to this, you know, 2x in 24 to 36 month kind of return. And that's just not normative. But if you're someone who you want to diversify out of the stock market, you understand and can, you know, take advantage of the tax benefits in real estate, and you're willing to hold 5, 7, maybe 10 years in cases, you're not going to lose. And if you're willing to go back to those fundamentals and say, this is why real estate has historically been a great investment, and you can appreciate it for that, then you're probably not going to be disappointed. And I think the final thing is rates. You know, when we were in 21 and 22, everyone was like, yeah, rates may go up a little bit, but like, you know, the cap rates are not going to expand much. Nothing bad's going to happen. And that was the story from investors, from brokers. And then, you know, we see what happened. Well, now the story's split, and it's the Fed will never lower rates meaningfully, or, you know, rent growth is never going to come back. We're in a cycle, you know, and the thing we know about the Fed, if probably one thing everyone agrees on, they are reactive, not proactive. They are going to wait. It's like the corporate role, right? Like, you don't want to make a decision and then get it blamed on you. You want to wait for a problem and then be the hero to solve the problem. So when something cracks in the market and their arms twisted and they have to drop rates, they will. And we don't know if that's in 2 months or 2 years. But at some point, rates will come down. Cap rates will compress somewhat with it. And, you know, real estate will suddenly be a great investment again. But the question is just how much time do we have to get through that? You know, what kind of risk are investors, you know, willing to stomach or take on in the meantime?
Good summary there. Mate, as we head towards the end of the show, what are your goals for, besides having a baby in 2025, but what's the rest of the goal? What does the rest of the year look like for you guys?
Yeah. So, you know, like I said, we're just now starting to look at multifamily deals again after our deals last year. So continuing to work on that on the acquisitions front. I suspect we'll do one, you know, maybe two deals this year. Probably not as gung-ho as what I was a year ago at this time. Then another thing we kind of spoke about off show before we started was kind of the whole mergers and acquisitions thing. I know you're doing a whole roll up of things and, you know, a big plan with investors. Mine's a little bit more vanilla than that. You know, I'm just looking at a business to buy that we can put in the systems, the operations, kind of like what we did with our short term rental business, but that can provide cash flow specifically for me, right? And really, I think a lot of the motivation behind that, one of the big problems I've seen in multifamily is sponsors that financially, because of how their business is structured, they have to do a deal every so often. You know, they need money coming in and it forces you to do bad deals. And so, you know, one of my personal goals financially is I don't want to be in a place where I have to do a deal. I want to do a deal because I really love it. And then I just invite investors to come along. And so that's kind of a part of aligning those interests in my sort of bigger picture plan.
That's love that. No, it's so true. And that's, yeah, we find ourselves that a little bit of that position at RSN, but that's more in the recent 12 months because we're just growing so quickly. You know, we've acquired 3 deals in the last 12 months. We've got 2 more you know, in the pipeline. So yeah, like it just, we need help. But yeah, I completely agree. There comes a point where growth is not the end goal. Right, it's sustainability, and I think that's what you know, whether it's a sustainability with six people, a team of six, or a team of two, I align with you on that and that vision. So, look, man, it's been a freaking awesome show. At the end of every show, we like to dive into the top 5 investing tips. It's a 5 question lightning round. You ready to get into it?
Let's roll,
mate. Number one, can you tell me what the daily habit you practice is to keep on track towards your goals?
You know, I am an endurance runner, triathlete. I've been doing that for years. It's pretty rare I miss a workout in the morning. But to me, my mind, I'm one of these people, it's just kind of all over the place. And I need that time in the morning to like kind of quiet my mind. So I would say, you know, getting a good workout every morning.
Love it. Love it. Question number 2 is, who's been the most influential person in your career to date?
You know, I think there was a guy, I won't mention his name on here, but, you know, I met him at a local RIA, specifically with multifamily. And this was when, you know, we were absolutely nobodies in real estate, hadn't done any deals, and was like, hey, I want to do multifamily. And just this guy was like, hey, come to lunch. Ultimately, he KP'd on our very first multifamily deal we did, which is the one that I think we're going to sell this year and do really well at. So, you know, very appreciative of someone like that, that had no reason to believe in us, but was just like, hey, I'm going to help you, you know?
That's awesome.
So hopefully I can be that to other people.
That sounds like you are, because I bet you're KPing a few deals, and I know I did the same thing. Someone gave me a leg up early on, and I've tried to do the same thing for folks who, you know, are genuine at heart and down to earth. So question number three is, what's the most influential tool in your business? When I say tool, it could be a software that you can't run the business without, or it could be a physical thing like a journal or a phone that you just can't run the business without. What is it?
You know, so when we started running our short-term rental business, I implemented using Asana, which is just project management software, like a monday.com or forget what the other common one's called. But I use that for everything. I use that for short-term rental, for Apogee, for personal, between like employee relationships. It's amazing because it's less of this blame game of you didn't do this or you didn't do this. And it's like Asana says you're supposed to do this by this date. So that's been a game changer just in my life in general, but you know, multifamily included.
I love it. I love it. I do need to, we still rely a little bit on Google Sheets, but, and Slack, but it's a good one to be reminded of. Second last question in one sentence, what's been the biggest failure in your career? What'd you learn from that failure?
I would say one thing that just immediately popped in my mind is actually when I was a senior in college, and, I won't tell the whole story cause it's a lightning round, but you know, I was doing final project, you know, design project, engineering, you have one person on the group not pulling their weight. And I go to my instructor, who was not a professor, but a retired, like, experimental Air Force pilot. And I just kind of vomited on him. It was like, hey, I don't know what the frick to do here. Like, this guy's not pulling his weight. We're exhausted. We're tired. You know, like, what kind of grade are we going to get? And he looked at me and he's like, hey, the important thing you're going to take from this class is not the grade you're going to get, because the grade's going to be fine either way. It's your ability to persuade and lead other people. If you learn how to persuade him and the rest of your team, either him to jump in or the rest of your team to fill in the gaps, you will take more from this class that will help you than anything else. And to this day, that's probably one of the most useful lessons.
I was in engineering as well. I don't think there's not a university group activity that hasn't ever been in the existence of history that there's not one person that doesn't pull their goddamn weight.
You know, I heard this joke, and it's like, hey, when I die, I want the people I did group projects with in school to lower me in my grave. That way they can let me down one last time, right?
I love it. That's freaking awesome. But good advice. And actually looking back on that, as you say that, yeah, like those group projects aren't necessary for the grade. It's for working together as a team to try and give you experience in the real world, because you're going to work with folks that won't pull their weight, and you got to crack the whip. Mate, last question. Where can people reach you to continue the conversation? That would be in your sphere. Where do they go?
Yeah, they can go to our website, check us out at ApogeeMFC, like multifamilycapital.com. You know, shoot me a message there, see what we're about. Love to chat with you.
Awesome, dude. Look, I want to thank you so much for jumping on today's show. Just to reflect some of the things that I took away from today's show. I think you since knowing you and Paul are so, you know, for the last couple of years, you're just down to earth. You're down to earth people. And I think your approach to your growth is really down to earth. And I think it speaks volumes for you in your career. But then also touching on just some of the distress we've seen in the market. And we're not immune to it, but taking solid, hard look at all of us, you know, and how we lead as sponsors, how we develop businesses, how we implement asset management, or, you know, good or bad, are lessons taking forward to help us be better investors in the future. So did I leave anything out with that little summary just there?
No, I don't think so. That was pretty good.
Awesome, brother. Well, look, thanks again for jumping on the show. Enjoy the rest of your week, and we'll catch up soon.
Thanks, Reed.
Well, there you have another cracking episode jam-packed with some incredible advice from Jonathan. Remember to head over to his Apogee Capital MFC, or Apogee, that's APOGEEMFC.com, to check out everything him and his wife are up to. If you do like the show, the easiest way to give back is to give it a 5-star review on iTunes or to share it with a friend. And we want to thank you all for taking some time out of your day to continue to grow your financial IQ, because that's what we're all about here on the show. We're going to do it all again next week. So remember, be bold, be brave, and go give life a crack.